You may recall last time we went a little deeply into the question of what hurts us most in life, what has hurt or what still continues to hurt most in life. And I hope that during the fortnight it has been possible for those of you who are here to extract something of inner realization out of such examination of what is most hurtful. Let us approach the question in a slightly different way today. When something hurts sufficiently, then it is as if one is near death. And our natural reaction is to shy away from it, to avoid it, to push it aside. Not because, in actual fact, we appreciate and value the real meaning of life, but because we cling on to this temporary existence here on earth. We are afraid. We don't want to let go, not merely this body as such, but all the unfulfilled desires, ambitions, and so on. All these forces are very strongly operative in us, whether we are conscious of it or not. But now, consider very carefully for a few moments. Death is on the border of transcendence. And we always turn back from it, if we possibly can. I don't mean death merely in the sense of the death of the body, but this feeling which oppresses us, this feeling like death, because the pain is too great, it's unendurable. We turn away from it. So that instead of breaking through, or shall we say, sailing through that barrier between life eternal and life as we see it in its little way here, we come back to the little here. And our little here is bounded by our shell of pleasure and the desire and the drive which seeks pleasure, comfort, security, happiness, as we define those terms. But death is the border of transcendence, I say. We haven't got anything like the capacity to let life in its totality be and fulfill itself through us. This is a very important point to realize. You know how Jesus said, "Be ye perfect." How do we interpret that word perfect? Most of us, if not all of us, think of the word perfect in our sense, namely, to bring to fulfillment according to our desire. Isn't that so? Whatever we are doing, or whatever we are participating in, as for example, if we are at a concert listening to a symphony, say, instead of attending to the symphony as such, we are hoping, expecting, wanting it to be, and we keep on comparing it with such and such a performance I heard, or such and such a conception which I have of how it ought to go. This is little we, what we are. We cannot just listen to it purely. And if it happens to tally with what we want, then we say, "Ah, that was just perfect." But the Greek word in the New Testament for "be perfect" is teleios, T-E-L-E-I-O-S, to anglicize it. Teleios. And you know what its meaning is? Completely ended. Finished. Perfect. This is the meaning of death. That which is allowed to emerge into its complete ending. Completely finished in the sense that a craftsman finishes what he is making, puts the last touch on it. It cannot be made better. It is ended. It is completed. And in that sense, perfected. Teleios. Be ye perfect. Now, if we really appreciate that, we will also appreciate what beauty is. If that which comes into being is not allowed to come to its complete finishing, and therefore perfection, to death in the grand sense of the term, then we have not lived, and we don't know life. Consider this in relation to what hurts, therefore. That which hurts seems to us to be inimical. It's something which we set ourselves up against, and we fight it, we oppose it, or if we are afraid because of the opposing force against us, we want to run away from it, to escape it, to seek security somewhere, somehow. No. that which hurts is the perfecter. The chisel and the mallet in the hand of the divine sculptor, which releases the perfect being. See, if we can really see into this, we shall know happiness. And that happiness will hold intense hurt, it will hold death as one of its most marvelous aspects. And if we can do that, we are freed forever from this slavery to the pleasure drive. We are free. Let us not mix this up with that kind of resigned acceptance, which is only a sour putting up with it. We think we solved the problem or the conflict that way. It is not our business to solve anything, but it is our business to bring every discord to its resolution and let the alternate play of concord and discord, which makes the whole symphony of life, flow on, and that is harmony. It is not a case either of acceptance or of rejection. It is a case of such understanding that there is whole being, which includes birth and death. And insofar as what is called death, or the terrible hurt, is complete and perfect in itself, in that is the fulfillment of man and his liberation, not otherwise. It's one of the great significances of Jesus on the cross. One of the great significances of the fact that the Buddha, with the realization of enlightenment, having emerged into true enlightenment, was concerned with the one thing, as he put it, deliverance from dukkha. But the deliverance is not an escape, not a solution of the problem, but a resolution of the total situation, so that life in its harmony is there. And therefore also the enlightened one takes upon himself the sorrow and the suffering of the world. Which does not mean being miserable about it. It's nothing to do with it. When one has truly understood sorrow and emerged into enlightenment, then there is perfect equanimity within us. That imperturbable calm, the continuous understanding, the awakened state, the state of insight, continuous and perfect insight. And in that state, the temporal play of birth, death, pleasure, pain, sorrow, joy just goes on. One is not apart from it. One is not involved in it in the sense of being bound and tied up in it. But one is completely involved in the sense of being that totality. You know, in the educational world, they say our object is to help the young children to become good citizens, to become whole persons. It is a lovely claim, but it is also a terrible conceit. I, the man who is confused, ignorant, incapable, full of conflicts, and the person who is going to help you, the little child, to become whole. This is the joke of life. So we have what we have in the world. And the polity and the economy of a nation is also concerned with the welfare, the happiness, the fulfillment of its people. The 1 or 100 or 1,000 people who compose the government, who are at the helm of state and so forth, themselves not altogether free from greeds and vanities and perplexities and follies and so forth, are going to release us and produce a state of affairs which is free from all these ills which assail us. This is life. Now don't ask, what can we do about it? We can't do anything about it. Let us realize that, not just see it superficially, not just give lip service to it. I have to acknowledge the fact that I am ignorant and I am incapable. If I do not acknowledge, after recognizing within myself, the fact that I am ill, I cannot begin to take the first step to call in the doctor and take some medicine. I have to recognize it. I have to acknowledge it. Yes, I am ill. I need medicine. We don't do that because we are too conceited. We are too proud. We are too deluded about ourselves. And partly because our conception of our being and of life is such a misconception. It's perfectly natural that the misconception comes about. We can't help it. Here we are. When we say we, naturally, this organism. I am this organism, obviously. But is that all? It's quite a different matter. This is a sign, just a sign, one sign of the whole fact. And because this sign is one which demonstrates its reality in terms of a separate existence as such, I am unable to see the full meaning of being. So I invent the term not being, non-being, as that which is not this organism, and lump everything else under the term non-being. But if we take even this planet alone, there are 3,400 million others who are part of that non-being. I don't think they would quite like being told by me that I am this is being and all of them are not being. In the Chandogya Upanishad, we have a very interesting discourse by Uddalaka Aruni. Aruni was the famous seer, the perfected one, who pronounced Tat Tvam Asi, that thou art. He is talking to his son. And he says, some people say that being emerged from non-being. But how can that be? How is it possible for being to come out of non-being? No, he says to his son, being came out of being. The intellect of the scholar, our ordinary intellects, will try to fit that sentence into our conceptions and our terms, which of course are the product of our experience and how far we have seen things. It may be interpreted as simply as, oh, a man comes into being because he is born of his parents. So out of two beings came this being. Perfectly true. But does that really need an enlightened sage to pronounce that? Sounds a bit pompous, isn't it? Rather absurd. How could a statement like that live as scripture for 30 centuries? But consider this thing. It's easy enough to say being and refer to our own living being. It's easy enough to say that that which is not manifested is non-being. The unmanifest is non-being. But herein we split up the totality into the unmanifest and the manifest, non-being and being. And very interestingly, Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says, when he is talking about what he himself is, higher than the manifest is the unmanifest. But higher than that unmanifest is another unmanifest. The highest being, Purushottama, I am that Purushottama, says Sri Krishna. And of course, all who have tried to translate the Gita have come up against this difficulty. What on earth can be the meaning of an unmanifest higher than the unmanifest? It sounds a confusion in terms. But consider, what I call being and non-being is simply what I can apprehend, which is called being. And what is beyond that, what is other than that, which is not manifest and not apprehendable by me, is called non-being. What is the actual fact of our existence? It is that out of the unmanifest, that is to say, out of the unparticularized, the unlimited, there emerges into existence in our world, in our universe, the particularized, the limited. Persons, things, phenomena, and so forth. That is true. And this which is manifest returns to the unmanifest with death. But the manifest and the unmanifest are one total reality. He who has realized this one total reality declares that he is the Supreme Person, Purushottama. Translated into English, Purushottama, the Supreme Person. But I think person is not too good a word. Because we immediately think of ourselves, persons. This is the trouble. The Upanishads give a fantastic etymology with regard to the word Purusha. Pur, before, meaning before, and Ush, that which was burnt up. And they say, in parenthesis, that which is burnt up is evil. The Purusha is person in that sense. But in that sense, person does not mean what you and I mean by the word person. So it did require some profound inward realization to arrive at that sort of realization. So now, the unmanifest, out of the unmanifest there emerges the manifest. The manifest returns into the unmanifest. And that return is through the portal of what we call death. But supposing you and I were capable of this awareness, this consciousness, in terms of the unmanifest, this unlimited, total consciousness, then we have to die out of that unlimited state in order to be born into the limited state here. Death is the portal both ways, from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. He who can truly see this, not merely intellectually, but really see it inwardly, he is the one who has, to use the common garden phrase, overcome death, conquered death, if you like to use those two not very good words in the context. But if death in that sense has been realized, then the one total reality will be realized as inclusive of being and non-being in continuous interplay. There is the continuous birth-death movement from the one to the other. And the Buddha, in his first noble truth, teaches that birth, jati, is dukkha, suffering, sorrow. Through the portal of death from the unmanifest into the manifest, through the portal of death out of the unmanifest, there emerges the birth of the manifest. And he calls that dukkha, suffering, sorrow. But by that same token, we could also see for ourselves that if through the portal of death the manifest, the jati, enters the unmanifest, that is also a form of jati. It is also a form of limited, particular, conditioned existence. So no one can escape from this life to enjoy the delights of heaven forever and ever. It will also have its dukkha. We cannot run away to heaven for security or fulfillment or happiness. Whilst in the state which is hurtful, which we commonly call unhappy, is the supreme possibility of realizing happiness in its fullness. In the state which we commonly call insecurity is the possibility of knowing the supreme security. Which means that what we have to free ourselves from is not the state in which we are, but our mode of awareness, our mode of apprehending that state. It is the trouble lies with our apprehension, the way in which we are conscious about it. Now this is fundamentally important for anyone who is concerned with the religious life, with the deep meaning of religion. It is not a changing of the state which is the important thing. It is this turning around in the deepest seat of consciousness, as Tibetan Buddhism puts it, for instance. This metanoia, this conversion, it is not a case of giving up this and entering into the true faith. We, the faithless ones, can never enter into the true faith. We can become the true faith because of this transformation of our awareness. And it is a true faith, not in the sense of opposition to a false faith, but in the total sense of the one total reality to which our eyes have been opened. So, look at death for what it really is. Portal of transcendence. And by that same token, the portal of imminence. That is why I spoke so much about from the particular limited condition, we, with the death of the limited manifestation, the body, we go into, there is the return to the unmanifest. But out of that very unmanifest alone can emerge this which is manifest. That is how it works. And the totality proceeds that way. So you see, we cannot go to someone for comfort in the real sense. We cannot turn to this ism or that sophy hoping to find heart's desire fulfilled. All the world plays at this game. And oh, how long it has played at this game. If I do not cling to life in the limited sense, confined to this little existence here, then death will not attack me or offend me. If I do not seek death to put an end to this misery, life will not continue to hurt me. Now you see why I said there is nothing you and I can do about it. We can see. And if this transformation, the real transformation of the mode of awareness takes place, then it will manifest itself in the limited and the particular. The event, that which happens, is the natural outcome, the inevitable, ineluctable outcome of the state of consciousness, the mode of awareness. This no scientist can legitimately say, because he'd be stepping out of his present province. However much he may inwardly, with his religious consciousness, see this to be true, but he cannot state it scientifically. Your philosopher would find it rather difficult to support this. And certainly your prime ministers and chancellors of the exchequers and all such fry, they dare not talk like this. They'd be out of office almost before the words were out of their mouths. But this is true. Whatsoever the situation around me, whatsoever the circumstance, whatsoever the event, whether it touch this or organism which I call myself, or whether it touch my surroundings, is the product of my mode of awareness. If that changes, if that transforms, then inevitably the situation transforms. I don't know the rationale of it. I have only discovered for myself that this is so. That's as far as I can go. So you see, it is folly to seek happiness, goodness, truth, beauty, wisdom. All these are names we give to what is. and of course these and their opposites, truth, untruth, falsehood, wisdom, folly. These are names we give to what is, as apprehended by us. This is the important point, our mode of apprehension. It is not unnatural for the question to arise in one's mind, how does one bring about this beatific state of apprehension, mode of apprehension? I cannot bring it about, because the I, in its confined, limited sense, is the very source of the non apprehending in that beatific way. But if I give the totality of whatever I am to that which is immediately here and now, then I have removed all barriers. There is the unhindered flow of life, of existence in its fullness. It's very difficult. And the root of the difficulty is the simple fact that this organism, this physical organism of ours, has evolved on the basis of the pleasure-pain mechanism. If the body did not have a really sensitive pleasure-pain mechanism, the body would perish in no time. This is a physical fact of organic existence. All organic existence is like that. All living creatures, plants, they are like that. The pleasure-pain mechanism is indispensable. And because our awareness is rooted in this pleasure-pain mechanism, it is very difficult for us to free it from the domination exercised upon our spiritual awareness by the pleasure-pain mechanism. But let us not make the mistake that we find in some unhappily presented religious teachings, that the body is evil, that it is a thing of sin. The body as body is simply the body. It is because, having eaten of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, this little mischievous elf called the mind steps in and tries to tear apart the totality, that I am in trouble. This is good. This is why? Because it is nice. It is pleasant. It is pleasurable. So I take sides of the one against the other, of the anabolic against the catabolic, of continuing to exist as one is and refusing death, the portal to transcendence, the supreme power which can transform. The mind is the thing that runs away from death, that opposes it. The mind is the thing that wants to get rid of our hurts and so forth, or to push them away somewhere. No, not that way. The mind has to learn to be completely absorbed by the totality. If the mind, as manifesting through each organism, allows itself to be absorbed by the totality, there is liberation here and now in the living body. Every element of the mind goes to its eternal home, its ashtam, as the Upanishad puts it. Goes to its eternal home, and its home is the unmanifest, the unlimited, the imperishable. Therefore, every thought, every desire, every impulse, every conception, every idea, every belief, whatever it is, must be allowed to dissolve away. Let it dissolve away. When the wind blows and the leaves fall dancing in the wind to the ground, I am in a state of delight. I don't say, oh, the poor tree has lost a leaf, let's put it back onto the branch. No. Far from it. When I, the person here, allow every thought, feeling, idea, belief, conception to go to its eternal home like that leaf dancing with ecstasy in the wind, then God is filled with delight. Would any of us like to be like a fruit which has ripened, past the ripe stage, become rotten, and still stick to the tree, disfigure the tree, spoil the tree? No. Now, in the letting go then, the completely letting go, allowing death, perfection, teleios, to play its part with every aspect of the mind, there is the realization of beauty and of happiness and of fulfillment. The falling of the leaf is the fulfillment. Not just as in springtime the leaf comes out. That is not the fulfillment. That is the beginning. That is the birth, the emergence. Then through the summer, the autumn, and the changing of the colors, the mellowing, the final manifestation, the finishing, the craft of the craftsman. Life is the craftsman. And then that last ecstatic, wonderful fall of the leaf. In this is transformation. And as we become aware in that manner, with respect to what we call ourself, comes the freedom from guilt. Not according to our conceptions of what ill or not ill means. Let the thing happen. If you don't let the thing happen, we are not in the state of grace. We are in the horrible state of opposing life. We are graceless then. You see, one of the deep meanings of tanha, craving, clinging to that which we should allow to dissolve away. Consider again our deepest hurt in life. We don't allow it to dissolve away. We cling to it. We have repressed it into the hidden recesses of the mind and congealed it there. So it acts in the mind like a calculus acts in the liver or the kidney or wherever you get calculi. Or like that obstruction in the brain which ends up with a cerebral thrombosis. That is what we do. And we alone are responsible for it. So, look at the hurt. Without arguing with it. Instead of the word hurt, take the word death. Look at death without arguing with death. And let death play its part. And we will find that everything goes to its eternal home. It is absorbed by and into the one total reality. And when that has happened, as it is put in the Subala Upanishad, which we considered some time back, death becomes one with the radiant supreme. Death is no other than life, both embodied in this, the person. You see, the world needs happy people. It's terribly in need of happy people. The number of human beings is increasing at an alarming rate. But this is not growth. This is almost like a cancer in the body of mankind. The number of its cells multiplying over rapidly. Therefore, mankind is sick. It's unhappy. It is miserable. It cannot be healed by rushing about doing this, doing the other, doing this, and so forth. But insofar as there are those who will see, understand, experience this complete transformation in awareness, in inner awareness, then those forces will be liberated by which the shape of things will change. It is a form of conceit that I must be up and doing something about it practically instead of talking and philosophizing about it. This is where the significance of religion lies. Religion is that which affects the transformation of our mode of awareness. When that transformation takes place, none of our conceptions or ideas have any validity in that total reality. It's too great, it's too wonderful, it's the unspeakable. It is the transcendent silence. The transcendent invisible in which is contained all potentiality of the visible. This awareness is not an illusion, as our dear intellectualists would like to believe. If it were an illusion, it would have been discovered long ago. That which really is illusory is like a bubble which gets pricked very quickly. It doesn't outlast the millennia. And it doesn't lead to profounder and profounder formulation here in our world, in terms of understanding and thought and perception and so on. Let us spend a few moments in quiet contemplation . Let the body be perfectly at ease without any strain . Alert, flexible, elastic. And in the mind's eye, let us look at a little infant. There is just the little infant, that's all. Just keep looking at that infant with the mind's eye. Recall your own children, any one of your children, when it was an infant, he or she was an infant. Look with perfect equanimity. That is, with perfect intensity, undisturbed by ideas or emotions. But look with complete intensity, that balanced intensity, which is true equanimity, equal-mindedness. Now, instead of any emotional disturbance, we may find that there is an outwelling from the heart of love, just love. Love which flows like a healing river of life, in which that infant certainly will not drown, but will grow. State, there is neither acceptance nor rejection of the infant. There is but love. There is peace. And there is the knowledge that for oneself, whatsoever pleasure or pain in connection with that infant comes about in our own life is of no consequence. We could easily give our own life for that little infant. Question of sacrifice or being noble or anything like that. Just a simple, ordinary fact, a truth of nature. Notice that with the mind calm in equanimity, there is no question then of grasping for the pleasurable in relation to the infant, or of fighting or refusing or running away from what hurts us in relation to that infant. Do we not become aware of the play of death which promotes and nourishes life in the infant, and therefore also of ourselves? See the great key to it, the love which wells out, something we don't know ordinarily in life. Love, we don't know it. We deceive ourselves that we do. But this mysterious thing beyond any analytical perception. Is life itself, is truth itself. And notice how it includes everything. Nothing is excluded. Pleasure, pain, sorrow, joy, everything. With the outwelling of love, selfness has vanished. With the vanishing of selfness, ignorance has vanished. There is a transformation of our mode of awareness. The infant is a symbol of the spirit. It is a sign of divinity, holiness, perfection, in the true sense, perfection. And if the spirit, which is the context of the religious consciousness and the religious life, can mean to us what perhaps in these few minutes that imaginary infant could mean to us. And if that love, which wipes out all selfness, can flow out in that same manner towards the spirit, inconceivable, unanalyzable, then for us the spiritual life becomes a living fact, a simple living fact. And its simplicity is its wholeness, which includes what in our mistaken state we call the non-spiritual, the material, the evil, and so forth.